The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Last program of the week. Sadly, no programs scheduled for tomorrow, so we'll have a little bit of extra Sabbath time for some reading and study. But we sure appreciate you joining us the last five Saturdays, and we may come back at it one of these weeks, but we're going to take a break from it here at Edstone tomorrow. But hopefully on today's program, we'll give you enough spiritual content to keep you moving right through the Sabbath and the whole weekend. Yesterday, they had, the jobless claims were updated, 26.5 million. You had another 4 to 5 million jobless claims this past week, and that amounts to 26.5 million over the past 5 weeks. The United States has shed 26.5 million jobs in 5 weeks' time. I think it was on Fox News where they said that since 2010, over the past 10 years, all 23 million jobs added. That's how much the United States added in 10 years. 23 million. And in 5 weeks, we wiped that off the books. And then some. 26.5 million. Pretty big news, although you'd never know it, given what President Trump said, I think over the course of about 65 seconds yesterday at the coronavirus briefing, where he, following what I think it was the doctor at the DHS, the leader of the Science and Technology Director, Bill Bryan, he was up there talking about how that this virus, it doesn't survive in the heat as long, and they're working with disinfectants and such. And then the president followed up after what he said and made a statement where it sounded like we had to test, putting light or putting some kind of disinfectant into bodies to see if we can kill off this virus. And oh, how much fun the press had with that. What a fool we have for a president, they said. What a fool. Disinfectants. Drudge actually put a shot of Clorox on it, as if the president of the United States wants for hundreds of millions of Americans to just start guzzling Clorox. Let's just listen to what this leader of the science and technology department of the DHS had to say. This is what would have led up to the president's statement. Clip one.
We've tested to date, the virus in droplets of saliva survives best in indoors and dry conditions. The virus does not survive as well in droplets of saliva, and that's important because a lot of testing being done is not necessarily being done, number one, with the COVID-19 virus, and number two, in saliva or respiratory fluids. And thirdly, the virus dies the quickest in the presence of direct sunlight under these conditions. And when you look at that chart, look at the aerosol as you breathe it. You put it in a room, 70 to 75 degrees, 20% humidity, low humidity. It lasts, the half-life is about an hour. But you get outside and it cuts down to a minute and a half. Very significant difference when it gets hit with UV rays. Mr. President, while there are many unknown links in the COVID-19 transmission chain, we believe these trends can support practical decision-making to lower the risks associated with the virus.
Okay, lost in the midst of all of the mocking and the ridicule, what he said there at the end is that I think what we're presenting here can actually assist you with your practical decision-making. Because right now we're trying to navigate our way through this process of coming out of lockdown. Everything's in lockdown. And should we venture out of our homes? Should we open up our shops? And we're coming into the summer months. A lot more heat, a lot more sunlight. Could that possibly factor in to his decision making? But no, it's how confusing the statement was coming from the president. Or how dangerous if everybody starts guzzling Clorox. That's the story. That's the story. But what have we been discussing in the last few weeks? What the authorities are suggesting, what they're encouraging us to do, what they're demanding in some cases. It's making matters worse. We need to get outside. We need sunlight. So whether you get it in some form, going outside, or supposing there is some kind of an injection, the president's there just saying, hey, maybe we can test this, maybe we can test that. But now he is the fool. He's the fool. Here's one more statement from Bill Bryan yesterday, clip two.
You'll see a number of some practical applications. For example, increasing the temperature and humidity of potentially contaminated indoor spaces appears to reduce the stability of the virus. And extra care may be warranted for dry environments that do not have exposure to solar light. We're also testing disinfectants, readily available. We've tested bleach, we've tested isopropyl alcohol on the virus specifically in saliva or in respiratory fluids. And I can tell you that bleach will kill the virus in 5 minutes. Isopropyl alcohol will kill the virus in 30 seconds, and that's with no manipulation, no rubbing, just spraying it on and leaving it go. You rub it and it goes away even faster. We're also looking at other disinfectants, specifically looking at the COVID-19 virus in saliva. This is not the end of our work as we continue to characterize this virus and integrate our findings into practical applications.
That's from Bill Bryan yesterday. And to me, it seems like he's suggesting that, look, if we go to more normal social distancing practices and continue with hygiene and cleanse things, clean up after ourselves, that we probably could return back to a relatively normal lifestyle. Now, whether the president got confused or what, I'm not even going to play what President Trump said. I'm sure you can find it if you want to go and try to piece together what it is you think he meant or if he was confused. But here's Mediaite. This is the left-wing website saying Trump suggests injecting disinfectant, shining UV light inside patients to kill coronavirus in a bizarre, rambling tangent. And then you have the big picture of Clorox bleach on the Drudge Report. Now, keep in mind, these are the same people who say that we need to be regularly pumping our bodies full of antibiotics, vaccines, painkillers, penicillin, antidepressants, Ritalin. We've got to have some drugs for the children. Pump them full of these drugs as well. It's all about the drugs. The drugs are the solution to this problem, we've been told. We've got to get a vaccine. A vaccine is the virus in a small form. The vaccine is the poison whenever they get it developed. And we want to put that inside of our bodies. So say the medical experts. And yet here comes the president saying, well, maybe we should test this kind of disinfectant or trying to get light onto this or heat onto this virus. And he's the crazy one. If anyone thought he meant, whatever his 65-second statement meant, if anyone thought he meant to guzzle a gallon of Clorox bleach, how crazy is that? We're living in a world where drugs are the solution. If the president is there saying, hey, maybe we can test some ways to kill off this infectious spread, that's what doctors do all the time with antibiotics, with vaccines. Antibiotics, has anyone ever looked into what's in the ordinary garden variety antibiotic that we put into our bodies? Go into a hospital sometime, maybe just to have a chat, and ask about some of the treatments. look into some of the things they do for cosmetic surgeries. Botox, for example, we inject that into our bodies. A doctor somewhere, a doctor's everywhere, presumably, would recommend that sort of thing as being totally harmless. There's all kinds of therapies in hospitals regarding radiation, chemotherapy, and there's disinfectants that we're consuming every day. If truth be told, we're consuming them every day. You probably consumed it this morning when you had a drink of water. Listen to this from 2018. It's from CNBC. I've mentioned this stat before, 250,000 people dying in U.S. hospitals every year because of mistakes. My little angel is how Christopher Jerry describes his daughter Emily as just a year and a half. At just a year and a half, Emily was diagnosed with a massive abdominal tumor and endured numerous surgeries and rigorous chemotherapy before finally being declared cancer-free. But just to be sure, doctors encouraged Chris and his wife to continue with Emily's last scheduled chemotherapy session, a 3-day treatment that would begin on her second birthday. It says, on the morning of her final day of treatment, a pharmacy technician prepared the intravenous bag, filling it with more than 20 times the recommended dose of sodium chloride. Within hours, Emily was on life support and declared brain dead. 3 days later, she was gone. Sadly, listen to this, sadly, Emily's case is not unique. According to a recent study by Johns Hopkins, more than 250,000 people in the United States die every year because of medical mistakes, making it the third leading cause of death after heart disease and cancer. Now, do we understand why Emily's case is not unique? It's because every single day, at a hospital near you, doctors are pumping patients full of drugs. That happens all the time. And sometimes they get it wrong. Disastrously wrong. Like in Emily's case, 20 times the recommended dose of sodium chloride. So we put sodium chloride inside of a human body? And the president of the United States, he's the crazy one. It makes you appreciate God's truth. On the Sabbath last week, I gave you this quote from the World Tomorrow booklet. Mr. Armstrong writes, the medical equation is this. One poison in your body plus one poison in the form of medicine equals no poisons. That's what they believe. All of them. It says one plus one equals nothing. Mr. Armstrong says that isn't the way they teach. that isn't the way they teach in second grade arithmetic. God's way, as Mr. Armstrong explained in that same booklet, is to avoid the poisons altogether. To avoid it. To not consume poisons at all. We've talked a fair bit in recent weeks. We've talked in recent weeks about the underlying conditions. So many of these health problems that coronavirus is exposing. If you want to look at, again, the typical Western diet, how many poisons are we consuming on a day? How many poisons, how many known cancer-causing agents are just, as a matter of routine, put into foods that we consume? Well, but I mean, it's a small enough dosage that it's not going to kill you on the spot. Okay, but how many of those cancer-causing agents kill you a little bit later? Maybe a few years later. You want to talk about injecting poisons into the human body? Well, good. I'm glad you brought it up. Let's have a discussion. let's have a discussion about what's in antibiotics or vaccines. Let's read the fine print. Let's delve into the subject of why this thing has to be pasteurized or why this has to be preserved with all these chemicals. Well, it gives it a longer shelf life. But is it good for you? What about stripping away all the nutritious value from the wheat kernel or the sugar cane? Just refine it. Refine, after all. It sounds so healthy. You're refining sugar? Well, yeah, I'm just taking it right down to the brilliant white sweet treat that it is. White flour, white sugar. So many of these processes, so many of these preservatives, so many of these chemicals put into foods. You can't even pronounce the words in most cases. Most people don't even read the fine print. This was from the South China Morning Post today about the epidemic in China. It's an eye-opening article. It says, what is diabetes and why are so many people suffering from diabetes in China? Did you know this? How many people are suffering from diabetes in China? It says, in 2017, the country was home to 114 million diabetics. 114 million. More than a quarter of the world's total cases, according to the International Diabetes Foundation. It says by 2045, that figure is expected to be 183 million. So a lot of, we don't know for sure because they've lied about the statistics, but how many people died of coronavirus in Wuhan or wherever in China as a result of just this one underlying disease? We now know this overwhelmingly. The targets for this disease have serious health conditions, in some cases two or three underlying conditions. Talks about the two types of diabetes. About 95% of all the cases in China belong to type 2. That's the worst, the worst of the two. It says in 2018, the nation's total diabetes-related health expenditure reached 57.3 billion yuan, according to HUA Medicine Report. By 2028, the spending figure is expected to triple. So this is indeed an epidemic. This is where coronavirus got started. And this is where there was undoubtedly tens of thousands of deaths because of it. And we've talked before about the Western diet and the Western nations that are being hit hardest by this disease. This was Dr. Oz yesterday on Fox News talking about the underlying disease, actually getting more to the cause, which you just don't hear enough of in any of these discussions. Here's clip three.
Another breaking news piece today, Northwell, big hospital system in New York, shared their results, you know, a large number of patients, and they found that 88% of the patients that got admitted to the hospital there had at least two core morbid conditions, like high blood pressure, diabetes, or elevated body mass index. In other words, overweight. And so the wake-up call for us might be, hey, listen, let's make sure we focus on folks who have these comorbidities, make sure they're not getting sick because they're the ones who go to the hospital and they really get ill, and maybe help them get past those comorbidities, because if you're home watching right now, that ought to be your most patriotic move. Try to lose a little bit of weight, get your blood pressure down, get your diabetes more in control, work with your docs on this stuff, because that might be one of the best ways for you to change a national history. God forbid you get COVID. COVID-19.
So improve your health overall so that you're not as susceptible to dying from a virus like COVID-19. That's what he's saying. This was from The Telegraph a few days ago. says, for a month, we've been looking at international stats on COVID-19, trying to piece together the puzzle. One pattern that has stimulated less discussion is the number of critically ill COVID-19 patients who are overweight or obese. Says the same ailments keep emerging: diabetes, heart disease, and high blood pressure. Data from the 2204 COVID ICU admissions shows 73% were overweight, a condition linked to those diseases. It says not only does carrying more visceral weight put greater pressure on the lungs, excess body fat causes the immune system to dysfunction, instigating the cytokine storm that floods lungs, causing pneumonia-like complications. Now listen to this. It says, for decades, successive governments have been negligent in tackling obesity head-on, whether it's subservience to the food and drink industry that contributes almost 30 billion pounds to the economy. So the food and drink industry, this is huge for the UK economy, 30 billion pounds. Or whether it's an aversion to becoming a nanny state, obesity has ballooned without concerted intervention. More than half of the British diet, listen to this, more than half of the British diet is ultra-processed food, with 60% of the population overweight. Here are some root causes. We're putting too much poison into our body. As long as we're on the subject of how crazy it is to put poison into our body, well, here's how you see it happening. Maybe it's happening in slow motion. It's still happening, though. None of us go for the Clorox bleach by the gallon. But over time, look at the impact. It says the OECD places the UK the sixth most obese country in the world. South Korea, at the bottom of the table, has a far lower death rate from COVID-19. So can we make the connections here? The UK is being hit harder, a lot harder than South Korea. South Korea, as it happens, they're near the bottom of the table with respect to obesity. The Telegraph says approximately only 1 in 8 Brits are metabolically healthy. That's astounding. Isn't this the bigger story than coronavirus? It should be. It should be. 1 in 8 in Britain are healthy. And the thing of it is, it just gets worse each year, doesn't it? The food quality. Of course, we can't blame it all on the food producers. We're making decisions daily. Each of us individually, and we all make mistakes. And we all consume things that we shouldn't consume. And we all inject things into our bodies that we know is not good. Now, there is something to be said for moderation. That's a law in your Bible. Moderation in all things, said Paul. It's not always just a matter of staying, you know, clear entirely of, let's say, unclean meats, like it discusses in Deuteronomy 14. That's to be avoided entirely. But there's other things where the Bible says, look, don't consume too much of it either, because then it will turn into a poison. So it takes not just wisdom and common sense, it takes a willingness to submit to the laws designed by our Creator. And it's challenging, I'll be the first to admit. It's hard to do in this world that's just so degenerate. You go through a supermarket and you have to search, as every God-fearing wife and mother can attest to. You have to really search to just find stuff that's good and healthy for your family. Well, talks about, well, let me just finish this. The government's own statistics say obesity causes over 30,000 deaths each year. So this just happens every year. 30,000. I forget where the UK is now on the COVID-19 deaths. 18,000, 19,000. This is every year. This is every year. 30,000. It says it cuts an average 9 years off life. So it cuts life short by 9 years. And it makes an individual more than twice as likely to develop high blood pressure and five times more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. It says the Department of Health estimates the cost of obesity to society is $27 billion a year, with annual spend on treatment greater than that spent on the police, fire service, and judicial system combined. But we just, you know, well, that's normal. That's normal. So, these drugs over here, that's fine. You've got this problem? Oh, well, take this drug. Take this drug right away. It'll disinfect. Let me tell you, that antibiotic, it'll kill off the bad bacteria and all the good bacteria. It'll kill off everything. Of course you take the antibiotic. That's what we've prescribed. You don't question our judgment. And yet here comes the President of the United States saying, well, maybe there's some way we can burn this off or disinfect this virus. That's what the medical experts are now trying to come up with. But he's, I guess, the lone fool in the world who's searching for some kind of disinfectant to kill off a virus. Mr. Armstrong said in the Tomorrow's World publication, the very first trouble with our deteriorating physical status is that we take sickness for granted. We seem to assume sickness is natural and necessary. A cold or a fever is merely a sudden, violent elimination of toxins and poisons you have injected into your body by wrong diet, which has broken God's physical laws. Cause and effect. Whosoever commits sin transgresses also the law. 1 John 3 and verse 4. And then when physical laws are broken, like Mr. Armstrong taught, sickness and disease are the result. It says, this is from The Plain Truth About Healing, when a person is sick or has contracted a disease, he is simply paying the penalty of transgressed physical law in his body. See, we've brought it on ourselves. That's the way like I said last Sabbath, that's the way we want to look at it. That's how we want to react or respond first. Even if it is somewhat hereditary, or even if we did get a bad bout of it because we were in the presence of someone who had it, but still, it's our immune system that wasn't properly strong enough to resist against it. Someone sent me this. Where was this? I think I skipped over it in my notes. It was just an email update from this, I guess, naturopath or somebody along those lines in Canada. And she writes here, French scientist Louis Pasteur is widely celebrated as the father of germ theory. Louis Pasteur, that takes you back to the 1860s, 1870s. Celebrated as the father of germ theory, the idea that we become sick when our bodies are invaded by foreign organisms, such as bacteria, molds, fungi, and of course, viruses. And of course, she didn't say this, but the way to fight that off or to kill it off is to come up with, like Mr. Armstrong says, some kind of poison, some kind of disinfectant. That's been modern medicine for well over a century. This lady writes, what's not widely known is that other French scientists working in the same field in that era held somewhat different beliefs known as the terrain theory. They believed that the most important factor that determines whether or not a person becomes ill is not the presence of the germ, but rather the preparedness of the body's internal environment, the soil or the terrain, so to speak, to repel or destroy the germ. See, it was Louis Pasteur that won out the germ theory. That's what modern medicine has embraced. But it's the terrain theory that aligns with what's taught in your Bible. It aligns with what Herbert Armstrong taught us. Cause and effect. Mr. Armstrong talked about the normal condition of the human body. It's to be one of robust, invigorating, radiant, good health. And when that breaks down, we have ourselves to blame. Well, I'll refer you back to that program I did last Saturday. All those quotes, those excerpts from the World Tomorrow book. How different it's going to be in the world tomorrow when we get rid of the poisons, the disinfectants, the drugs, the vaccines, the antibiotics, the Ritalin, you name it. Go to your local pharmacy. Look at what's on the shelves. Read the fine print. Try to pronounce the names if you can. Read through the side effects. Read through, in some cases, the dangerous, dangerous side effects. Mr. Armstrong talked about education in the world tomorrow. He says it's not natural to be diseased. It's unnatural. Educate people in the laws of good health, proper diet. God designed certain foods for good health. Some things that grow are not designed for food. Some are poison. Educate people in sanitation, hygiene, required amounts of sleep, pure water, fresh air, sunshine, and exercise. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Can you imagine a world without famine, disease, and pestilence? A world free of crime, war, and hatred? Man has tried throughout history to rid the world of these problems, but to no avail. Will man ever find the way to peace? The Bible speaks of a soon-coming utopia in which God will finally bring us peace. It will be a world governed by God's law of love. Poverty, famine, illiteracy, and escalating violence will be reversed. The dry and barren lands of the world will be made fertile, and resources will be plenteous. Sickness and disease will be replaced by robust and prosperous living. The language barrier will be bridged, and an education in the true values of life will flourish the world over. Beyond this bleak, unhappy, present-day reality is this soon-coming future. Our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, is free at our website, thetrumpet.com. Download it or request it free today.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I think I've mentioned this essay before that Winston Churchill wrote back in 1931, titled Moses, the Leader of the People, and he came out in defense of Moses as an actual historical figure. There were those saying that the events of the Bible and even some of the individuals of the Bible weren't really real. It's more allegorical. And Churchill took exception with that. He said Moses was a national hero that led the people of Israel out of bondage, that led them through a dark hour. He said this about Moses' training, his preparation for that calling. He said, every prophet has to come from civilization, but every prophet has to go into the wilderness. He must have a strong impression of a complex society and all that it has to give, and then he must serve periods of isolation and meditation. This is the process by which psychic dynamite is made. Every prophet needs this. And of course, what's interesting about this essay, as I've noted before, is he wrote it in 1931. He's just entering into The wilderness years, as Martin Gilbert called them. He's just entering into this time of being a political outcast. And as I've explained before, what a productive time that was for Churchill, the 1930s. All those books and articles and speeches, he was sounding the alarm. Everyone else wanted to appease Adolf Hitler, and Churchill was sounding the alarm. And then he came out of the wilderness. Well, did he ever? He came out in 1940. Well, I guess before that, as First Lord of the Admiralty back in 1939. But all of that, he said so when he was finally made prime minister. He said, I felt like I was walking with destiny, that all my past had been but a preparation for this hour and this trial. He saw that time in the wilderness as crucial preparatory time for this great calling. Just like with Moses, he made the most of those wilderness moments in the 1930s, and then look at what he did in the 40s. Moses, too, made the most of his wilderness moments. Acts chapter 7, notice verse 20, it says, "In which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and mighty in words and deeds." So he was brought up for 40 years right at this royal court, the Pharaoh's daughter. A strong man, a mighty man in speech and action. A great politician. Josephus writes about his great military conquests for Egypt. Well, the story continues, verse 23, "And when he was a full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian, for he supposed his brethren would have understood that God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not." He thought, well, surely these people understand I'm a big shot. Surely they understand that I'm gonna lead them eventually. And well, the Israelites didn't see Moses that way. Verse 26, "And the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove and would have set them at one again, saying, Sirs, your brethren, your brothers, why do you wrong one another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Will you kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday? And then fled Moses at the saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begat two sons." Moses fled for his life because when Pharaoh found out that he killed that Egyptian, he wanted to kill Moses. So Moses ran into the wilderness. He went from being this up-and-coming, powerful politician and military leader to just being a nobody. A political outcast, you could say. He stayed with Jethro. He was a priest in Midian. Probably a nomadic desert tribe of some kind. And there he was, driven into the wilderness. And God's the one that orchestrated all these events. Because he needed more training. As it happens, he needed training in the wilderness. Verse 30, "And when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Eternal in a flame of fire in a bush." So 40 years into it, God didn't say, okay, you've been in there 1 year, you've been in there 3 years, you've been by yourself, you've been all alone. 40 years. I think it says in the old literature, the Worldwide Church of God literature, that it took him that long to unlearn all of the false concepts and ideas that he had picked up in this higher education he would have received in Egypt. And certainly he needed to be humbled as well. Verse 31 says, "When Moses saw the burning bush, he wondered at the sight, and as he drew near to behold it, the voice of the Eternal came unto him, saying, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob." And then Moses trembled. He trembled before God. God told him to put off his shoes and so on. And you can keep reading the account. You can go back to Acts 2 and see that that account as well. But here, before Moses had said, surely these Israelites, they know I'm the big-time leader here. And now God says, look, you're going to lead my people. And Moses protested. Moses said, I'm not ready for something like this. I can't do this. I've got a speech impediment. Verse 36, it says, he brought them out after that he had showed wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is he, verse 38, that was in the church in the wilderness with the angel which spoke to him in Mount Sinai and with our fathers who received the lively oracles to give unto us. So what a story. What dramatic and exciting, inspiring history. He needed that time in the wilderness to, as Churchill said, produce a little psychic dynamite, to meditate, to draw near to his creator. We all have a little more alone time ourselves during this period of lockdown. We all have a little bit more time with our families. And even in the broader sense, you look at the church today and we're not quite out at center stage just yet. It's coming. But how important is it for us to make the most of these preparatory years, these preparatory months or weeks, so that we're ready for our calling, so that we're ready for center stage? Hebrews 11, verse 24 says, by faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God, than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. He chose to serve God instead of just immersing himself into the sinful pleasures of this world. Verse 26 says, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. He was a man of vision. By this point, he had learned a lot with his 40 years of training. And now he was prepared. Now God could really work through him. Now God could really empower him and strengthen him and lead him. Well, with respect to the Israelites, let's just look at Deuteronomy 8. Because as we know, they spent their time in the wilderness as well. They didn't learn the lessons that they needed to learn. The adult generation had to die out, basically, in that wilderness environment because they lacked faith. They didn't believe. They weren't humble. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 1, it says, all the commandments which I command you this day shall you observe to do, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Eternal sware unto your fathers. Verse 2 says, and you shall remember all the way. This is Moses writing to the Israelites, preaching to the Israelites. You shall remember all the way which the Eternal your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to prove you. In other words, they were being tested. To be tested, to be humbled, to know what is in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or no. See, when we're kind of out of the limelight, when we're carrying maybe a lower profile, that's when God's really evaluating us to see whether or not we'll obey, to see whether or not we'll humble ourselves and really know from the heart that we're supporting God and his work and we're enthusiastically doing it. Verse 3 says, and he humbled you and suffered you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you knew not, neither did your fathers. So they were tested every day, whether they were going to follow God's instructions or not. God sent manna from heaven, and they had to go out and gather it up, all these seeds, and then prepare it. Wholesome, filling food from God, full of nutrients, not poisons, not all these man-made ingredients, the perfect food. And well, if you know anything about the story, they came to resent that. And they started talking about all the Egyptian dishes that they enjoyed. They started saying that, well, maybe life in slavery and captivity was pretty good. Moses, you brought us out here to die. God's way of life, it's bad for us. It hurts us. God said, you're hurting yourselves. It's all these worldly customs and traditions that you want to come out of. And if you do that, I'll show you the way. I'll give you the truth. I'll reveal to you my law, my perfect, holy, and righteous law that's there to help you, that's there to give you health and vitality in the physical and spiritual sense. Well, there were other miracles. The raiment waxed not old during that period. Verse 5 says, you shall also consider in your heart that as man chastens his son, so the eternal your God chastens you. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the eternal and walk in his ways and fear him. For the eternal your God brings you into the good land, a land of brooks, of water, of fountain. He was going to take them into the promised land. And they could have gotten there a lot quicker if they just would have been obedient. But what happened? Verse 11 says, beware that you forget not the eternal in not keeping his commandments and judgments and statutes. Don't trust in the the physical riches and abundance of this world. Look to your creator. Look to your maker. Look to your great God. Well, all of this, I won't get into all the details here, but suffice it to say, as 1 Corinthians 10 brings out, it's all for us and our learning. The history is there recorded for us. The wilderness years for the Israelites, the wilderness years for Moses. Even Paul, when God struck him down on the road to Damascus, he spent a number of years in the wilderness receiving some pretty intense education from Jesus Christ. He was in Arabia for years. And then when he came out to center stage, he was ready. He had been thoroughly prepared and trained. Isaiah 66, remember, talks about our spiritual birth happening overnight. And then it's there, and everyone sees it. The whole world sees it. We've got to be ready for that. We've got to be preparing for that. Notice 1 Peter 2 and verse 9, a familiar verse here, a memory verse. Peter says, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We're a peculiar people. Those of us in God's church, in God's family, a royal priesthood, the leaders of tomorrow, the presidents, the prime ministers, the kings and priests. Today, though, it says, verse 11, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. We're just strangers in this world. Pilgrims, you're just going to be there for a short time, God says. Think about the next world. Think about your responsibilities in the wonderful world tomorrow, when there will be perfect health, perfect government, a perfect economy. And when nations are not going to be warring against nations anymore. Hebrews 11. If you look at some of these heroes of ours in Hebrews 11, they really did see themselves as pilgrims. They were just passing through this life. Their sights were set on the next life. Verse 8 of Hebrews 11 says, by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out not knowing where he went. He didn't even know where he was going. The Israelites didn't know. They just They just were told, hey, follow the cloud, follow the pillar cloud. Now, this doesn't mean we don't plan or prepare or lay out a, you know, a five-year plan or set goals for the next few years. But if God says, let's go this way, then we go. If he says, turn right here, we turn right. We look to him. Abraham was called out of his world. Everything that he was comfortable with, everything that he was familiar with, God said, look, I want to take you to a place that you don't even know. And Abraham did. He followed. Verse 9, it says, By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same people. So he lived in a strange country. He dwelt in tabernacles, a temporary dwelling. And God made all these promises to him. You're going to be a great nation, a company of nations, in fact. And, of course, the spiritual promise of salvation, of grace as well. Verse 10 says, for he looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. See, Abraham looked even beyond the world tomorrow to New Jerusalem. Verse 11 says, through faith also Sarah received herself received strength to conceive seed and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the sea, the seashore innumerable. So here again, they had their, you could say they had their wilderness years, even after they came out of what, you know, what they were all familiar with. They head into this land of Canaan, and for 25 years, they meditated on these promises God made to Abraham, that they were to have a son, that they were to have a great multitude of people ultimately. And all these years, before Isaac ever came along, those were some wilderness moments as God prepared them for their future. Verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. We've got to keep that perspective. Even if we die before the return of Christ, we see that city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. We see it far into the future. We see it as if it's right next to us. And we see ourselves as strangers and pilgrims on this earth, citizens of God's kingdom in heaven, representatives of God's coming government, letting our lights shine on this earth. This earth that goes darker and darker with each passing day. Verse 14 in the Revised Standard, for people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland, and truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned, but now they desire a better country, verse 16 says, that is, an heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Jesus said in John 14 that I'm going to go away and prepare a place for you in that family government. Just make sure that when I'm away, you prepare, you take advantage of those wilderness years or whatever you want to call them, your pilgrim years. Churchill took advantage of his. He wrote the entire Marlborough series during the 1930s. He wrote other books too. He wrote all kinds of articles and speeches. Henry Steele Commager says, it is not a distortion to see in Marlborough an embryonic Churchill acting out on what seems to us a more restricted scale the role Churchill was to play with such splendor and bravura. On a global scale, like Marlborough, Churchill was called upon to rescue Europe from the grasp of a tyrant to preside over a prodigious political and military coalition, to sustain allies who faltered and drooped, to fire the spirits of those who were reluctant, to assuage those who thought they contributed more than their share, and to prepare or persuade the British people to bear over cruel years the blood, toil, tears, and sweat of war. His training during those wilderness years, it helped prepare Churchill for the monumental challenges ahead. Make the most of your time, your preparation ahead of the return of Jesus Christ. Make the most of your time in these quieter moments right now that we all have a little bit more of. Make the most of these important years, or maybe I should say weeks, days, weeks, and months of crucial preparation. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you on Monday.